102 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. Evening shows begin at 7:30 p.m. and matinees at 2 p.m. For more info and a schedule and to get tickets, go to portlandplayhouse.org, or you can visit stageandstudio.org, where I have that link, and I'll have the podcast on iTunes later today. Also, you can like us on facebook.com/stage, the letter and studio, and I'll have all of the news there. Mia Chung, thank you so much for joining me live in the studio today. It's been a real treat to get to know you and to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
And break legs on this production, but also your future work, too. So thank keep you. Us posted, definitely. Well, that's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to Janet Anderson, my intrepid engineer. And the show will be online later today, stageandstudio.org, iTunes. And you can also tweet me anytime at Stage, the letter and studio. Till next time, I'm Dimay Roberts. We're going to go out with more Orchid Ensemble at orchidensemble.com.
Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is photographer Michael Primo. His show, Water Warriors, is on now at New Space Center for Photography through February 20th, 27th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Michael.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You've done this show of photographs in conjunction with another photographer, Andrew Stern. The pictures are kind of mixed in together, but the subject is the same. You went up to Canada, where Southwestern Energy was exploring for natural gas. They wanted to do fracking, and then the local population sort of came together, seemingly across race and class lines, and united to try and keep them out. So just tell us when that was, and how long you spent taking pictures, and what was the goal of your work there?
Yeah, so this event happened in the middle of 2013. Southwestern Energies, this Texas-based company, started exploring for natural gas. And in New Brunswick, Canada, deeply rural community at the very top of the Appalachian Mountains, folks.
Where is that exactly?
It's north of Maine. So we ended up driving there. It was about a 20-some-hour drive from New York City. It's like 2 or 3 hours past the Maine border.
Uh-huh. Is it south of the St. Lawrence?
North of the St. Lawrence.
Okay.
Yeah,
so it's way up there.
Yeah, way, way up there in this area they call the St. John's Bay, the little provinces on the Atlantic coast they call the Maritime Provinces. And it's at the end of so in Canada, there's, you know, this energy boom that's happening because we literally now can get blood from a stone in the form of extracting petroleum from the oil sands in Alberta, Canada. And Canada is furiously trying to figure out how to export that. Thankfully, the southern part of the Keystone Exxon pipeline was turned down earlier this year. But, you know, Canada's still trying to figure out how to get those to foreign markets. And the terminus, the end of the Energy East pipeline, is New Brunswick, Canada, which is on the Atlantic coast. And despite Canada talking about, oh, we need to have get off foreign oil and this will be a local job creator, their desire is to increase their access to overseas markets, India and China, to export all this bitumen, this petroleum from the oil sands in Alberta. And in order to support building all those, the infrastructure, the pipelines, the refineries to ship and process the petroleum, they need to frack natural gas because they need an increasing amount of energy to be able to power all that infrastructure. And so where they want to do that is right smack in the middle of this beautiful, pristine land, that the Elsipuktug First Nation, which is an indigenous community in the region. The Mi'kmaq people is the community, and they stretch from Maine up into the Maritime provinces. They claim that they've never ceded the land. They were not properly or adequately consulted about these sort of energy extraction. These indigenous folks literally for 400 years have been at odds with the local settlers, English speaking, and there's also still a substantial French speaking Acadian population up there. And despite these 400 years of sort of disagreements and outright hostility, these communities came together around this issue of protecting their land and protecting their water. And when Southwestern Energy came to explore, they explore with these thumper trucks that drive really slowly down these rural highways.
This is like a pickup truck or a semi? Or?
It's a massive truck about the size of a kind of a city dump, what's it called? They pick up garbage, a garbage truck. It has this giant kind of lead plate in the center between the front and the rear wheels. And they drive for about 20 feet and they stop and they lower these plates. And they're called thumper trucks because they blast this sort of seismic energy into the earth.
Mm-hmm. And like a shockwave?
Yeah, exactly. And it creates this like thumping sound. It's like... and then they move on. And so these folks incensed at the government's attempt to threaten their water supply set up a series of blockades to prevent this exploration from happening.
So they're trying to block they're doing this on a normal highway, the thumper trucks?
Yeah, completely normal, like two-lane rural highway.
Right. So people came out, and what did they do first? You've got pictures of a woman in a sort of orange and white snow jacket with a woolly hat, and behind her a bunch of policemen who look really cold and wet. What's going on in that picture?
So in this particular picture, every day the local activists would, through a series of communication with each other, they'd have scouts who would start out in the morning and rise at dawn, and then figure out where the thumper trucks were that day. And then they would radio or call to their friends and colleagues who would then come out to meet the thumper trucks. So in that particular picture is an example also of this the fact that this effort is run by or led by primarily women, primarily these older, elder women who were really sort of incensed by this and felt a severe need to protect their children and their young people from the threat that SWN and fracking poses to their future. And so they would line the road and then try to prevent and obstruct these trucks from exploring or from moving down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to be indifferent to the police. They tried to be as indifferent as possible and only engage Southwestern Energy. But the police and the state, as it does, was not there for their protection. The state was there to protect the company and their sort of corporate and economic interests rather mm-hmm. than the will of the people.
Right.
And so they took it upon themselves to intervene.
So then you've got images of guys in camo with hats and hoods and things behind a bunch of tires. And the tires, I see a little flame, a tiny flame in the middle of one. There's a guy lighting a cigarette, it looks like, or maybe he's vaping in the background for his health. What's going on there?
The Canadian government had issued these injunctions. One of the processes of sort of dehumanizing the indigenous folks, the sort of colonial state, would call all indigenous people just John and Jane Doe Indian. And so they released this injunction that said John and Jane Doe cannot be anywhere near fracking exploration operations. And so that literally was like a blanket call to the police to just arrest any indigenous folk and any quote-unquote activists or anybody that they thought were activists that were anywhere near the highways.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a really rural community, so these highways are the major arteries that people use to get to work, see family, medical appointments, school. Upon receiving news of this injunction, folks grabbed whatever items they could and set up these barricades mm-hmm. on the highway. It happened to be near where there was a lot of tires and debris that had just been kind of thrown and dumped and a lot over years and years. So folks took these tires and they took these debris and they built these massive blockades in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm. You have an image of basically dirty water. It looks like a filthy pond with white scum and your kind of yellowy red residue. And the local farmer said he'd never seen this before, and the idea is it's chemicals used in fracking that came up.
Yeah. This farmer was just walking through his land and came upon this rainbow-colored sludge swamp that was not there a week prior. And this is his private land.
Was the swamp there before?
There had been no swamp. It was completely dry land. And there was little tags on trees that had Southwestern Energy, the acronym is SWN. They had SWN and then kind of a date marker and then a sort of a series of numbers. Mm-hmm. And what had happened is SWN had gone onto his land and punctured. They do what they call shot holes, where they blast a little capsule into the earth that is designed to find these shale gas deposits. And kind of comes up. They're not called bullets, but these capsules have a chemical solution in them. And again, these fracking companies do not want you to know what they are. They're highly patented. They're so severely protected that even in the state of North Carolina, if your doctor discovers that you have some illness that is related to any of these chemicals that are in this compound, your doctor by law cannot tell you what caused it. And it's a law passed by Halliburton. So these men were walking along their land and they saw this explosion of chemicals. And this was really kind of a catalyzing event in their local community, that brought together some of the white farmers with, the indigenous folks that were like, look, this is beyond the pale.
This is private land?
Completely private land.
How did they get on this land?
They just walked on. And, you know, the state has the interest of corporations, first and foremost on their agenda. So these folks have little or no recourse to these actions.
Mm-hmm. So in this show, you're taking portraits, you're taking, photojournalism, people doing stuff. Yeah. And then you've got this one picture of a bunch of trees covered in snow, mm-hmm. kind of in close up. It's all tree. Mm-hmm. It's all branches. What is that for?
So, yeah, I'll back up a little bit and say that there is about 36 images in the total show. Yeah. And those 36 images are divided into 8 what we call panels. And so each panel is a mosaic of several images. And some of the biggest images are big. I love big, beautiful prints. And it's a kind of part of my aesthetic and part of my political outlook is to heroicize folks who are already heroes and to really support the sort of dynamicism of communities and their ability to fight against these really powerful interests. And so we have these big 20 by 30 images organized into panels of 4 images, kind of like tiles. And the idea was to juxtapose the sort of beautiful serenity with the sort of plea for the need to protect the earth. So that image is juxtaposed next to an image of a longhouse that has this banner that says SOS, Save Our Mother Earth. And this is that, the longhouse where that banner is where they would have their meetings. Again, highly democratic, consensus-based discussions around how the people wanted to address this threat to their land and water.
Mm-hmm. But the trees, why are they next to that longhouse?
The idea is that this is what people are fighting for. Like this mm-hmm. is the longhouse represents the tradition. It represents a tradition being continued because that's where they're continuing to dialogue with their community and make decisions.
Yeah.
And there's also an image of a campfire which is shot at night beneath the trees. And those two images are meant to really kind of represent the pristine beauty that these communities are trying to preserve.
It looks like that's the moon and a contrail from a plane, and then you've got lights from fires. When you're shooting and you're out, it's obviously tons of things going on. Are you thinking in terms of groupings of panels or pictures that this will illustrate that kind of thing?
No, not at all. When we're out there shooting, again, this show was all produced with my collaborator, Andy Stern, is another photographer who we have worked with for a while now. And we're just there to honor people's intention around why they're there and what they're trying to achieve. And so our job is to document that in a way that we feel is honest. And then when we get back to our studio and we have this mass of photos, that's when we go through it and sort of figure out how what we captured can accurately express what these people were trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Michael Primo, photographer whose show Water Warriors is on now at New Space Center for Photography through February 27th. So, Michael, you say you go out, you shoot a lot of different stuff, and then you come back to the studio, and then you kind of arrange it. So in this case, you arrange it into a gallery show. What other things are you doing with the material?
So we have a kind of a full, what we call a full-scale gallery show, which is up now at New Space. Mm-hmm. We have a smaller pop-up version, we call, where we've printed all those sort of eight panels I was referencing onto these silk sheets. And those are designed to be more nimble and be carried to activists, like really sort of grassroots activist spaces. Mm-hmm. So we've been doing a lot of work in rural North Carolina, where a moratorium on fracking was just lifted. And we've been bringing these silk sheets to grassroots organizing spaces as a way to have a case study for folks to think about, oh, here's a success story about here is how a particular community overcame divisions of race, class, color, and culture and came together over a shared purpose. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of the pie. We're also working on a short film. And the short film we hope will be out by the summer. And the short film will probably be a 20 to 30 minute short film, that tells a piece of the piece of the story that, complements the still photographs. And the piece that the still photographs don't necessarily fully complement is the still photos. So the gallery show, which you'll see at New Space, is full of quotes and stories from people. And we've taken a kind of different approach to captioning than some documentary photo shows, where you just kind of see, oh, the name of the photo and kind of where it was taken, mm-hmm. and the material that it's on. Well, we've tried to tell a story with the caption. So as you read the captions, there is information about the actual photos, but it's also sort of peppered with direct quotes from people, as well as the larger story of what their struggle is. And so the short film will allow people to speak for themselves. And it also captures a confrontation which happened on October 17, 2013, which is really the sort of apex of this particular struggle, where these activists had blockaded the road, and Southwestern Energy had made the unlucky mistake of parking their trucks in a field. And the space between the road and the field was private land. It's a rural area, so it's really hard to tell what our boundaries. So they had no idea. But luckily, they had no idea. The private owner of that land was sympathetic to the aspirations of his community and really leery about the intentions of the fracking operations. And so he invited folks to camp out on their land. And so that created the most effective blockade of this entire struggle, where they were completely preventing the company from moving their trucks. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. The trucks were in there, I guess, for about 3 or 4 weeks. So it was about a month. The company claims that they were losing upwards of $3 to $5 million a day. I think that's a conservative estimate, too.
This is just being in the way of a parked truck, and the company will not try and drive it out.
Yeah, exactly. And so the company enlisted the state and the police to come and rout these activists. And again, these are, you know, led by young people and older women. Mm-hmm. And they came with their post 9/11 police force with like urban assault vehicles, tear gas, rubber bullets to try to move the activists. And that was quite a scene that we have captured that will be in the film, which isn't fully represented in the photos. The kind of the severity of the confrontation.
What happened?
Basically, you had urban assault vehicles, you had snipers in the woods, you had full like assault tear gas and sound bombs, and they came and they tried to smoke out the activists. They were able to move them enough to get the trucks out, but ultimately, as this was happening, you know, this sort of barrage of text messages just kind of went out, you know, kind of like telephone throughout the community. And by midday, the ranks of the activists had quadrupled. It's really hard to know what the numbers were exactly. But again, you picture a small two-lane rural highway that was just filled with people kind of as far as the eye could see, where people were just sort of taking any route they could to just reinforce the blockade. And the police with tear gas and rubber bullets were able to push the activists back. enough to get some of the trucks out. But then as sort of activist reinforcements appeared, they were able to then again push the police back. And it was one of the most tremendous things I've ever seen. And I've been a part of a lot of sort of large social movements. I was part of the very start of Occupy Wall Street in Zuccotti Park, and some other sort of activist social movement work. And this by far, just, I don't know, I was humbled and awed and deeply inspired.
And you were videoing
it? Yeah, and we were videoing that. It resulted that there was the activists set 8 police cars on fire in that effort to push back the police. It was one of the most tremendous things I've ever seen.
And are any of the images of that?
Burning
tires?
Yeah, some of the burning tire video photos are of that confrontation. We've tried to, it was just such a tremendous and crazy thing to see. We've captured those moments more abstractly. So there's one of the images. There's this image of fire with a person, a figure, kind of with his hands in a I don't know what you call this, like a triangle shape above his head, collapsed together. There's another image of a young person all in camo with a mask on, sort of waving his flag in front of a burning blockade of road with the sort of police headlights far off in the distance.
You're a photojournalist. Nobody poses for you. You don't tell people what to do. You just take pictures. And you said you look for heroic imagery. Was it easy to find in a confrontation like that?
Yeah, I think it was very easy to find. And you know, there's an amazing man named Chokwe Lumumba, who was the one of the founders of Malcolm X grassroots movement, and he was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. And he had a saying. He said, "If you don't love the people, you will eventually betray the people." And I think the source of my creativity comes from that deep love for people and of their aspirations to free themselves from these bonds that have been on us for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so the heroicism comes from finding what it is that people aspire to and recognizing their love of their people and their community and their dreams. And that's where those sort of heroic images come from, that sort of intersection of me recognizing what it is they're most passionate about.
Mm-hmm. So then you have some very domestic scenes, people eating a meal. It's moose meat and fry bread. And
yep.
There's a guy scraping out a pan of, looks like stew. Mm-hmm. There's like fudge brownies in the foreground. You know, he's in a regular kitchen. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's the same guy in a green shirt in front of a wood pile just smiling. Why did you pick such domestic imagery?
So this was, again, part of our effort to not fall down the rabbit hole of like riot porn, quote unquote, and not.
Oh, is that what it's called?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I call it. I don't know. I'm sure other people call it that, right? And not kind of overly fetishize the sort of direct action and the sort of confrontation with police, because ultimately, it's like the confrontation with police is an aside. That's not the point. The point is we have this aspiration to protect our land, protect our communities. And it was really important to represent what it is people are trying to protect. And what people are trying to protect is trying to protect their ability to self-determine their own future. And their self-determination is represented by their ability to go home at the end of the day and have enough food to sit with their family in a house that is warm, to even have a house in the first place. And that's the will of the people to actualize their own self-determination. And so it was really important for us to represent that aspect of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of confrontational stuff is really just male display behavior, I think. It's
guys
walking around with their hands held above their heads.
Yeah.
You know, you see it in England in soccer fans. There's a lot of standing there with your hands in the air, sort of showing off.
Yeah.
So you're trying to temper that with something that looks a bit further into what people really want.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like it's a great point, because there's this macho aspect to it, and that's not the point. Like, the point is to destroy patriarchy, not continue to replicate it and continue to validate it as though it's valid. And so it's really important for us to sort of represent the sort of domesticity and the vulnerability of communities. That's how we live, you know? That's what our aspirations were. Mm-hmm. And this one picture of the man you mentioned who's in front of a woodpile, beautiful man, Altidore Chazon, this Acadian, French-Acadian man, this lumberjack, He had been married to his wife for 50 years, and she had just passed away about a year ago. And he had taken to going out to the road to this blockade every single day. And I think it was really important for him, especially after the passing of his wife, to sort of find other members of his community to help, you know, push forward into the next phase of his life. And him making, he was so impressed by his ability to make food for us because he hadn't been used to it making food for that long. And he was really proud to welcome these folks who had come to, you know, capture his story. Very, you know, wonderful working class dude. And, you know, that's an important part of the story that we don't often see because it's obscured by this macho, like, fists in the air, we're in the street. But it's more than that. The street is just a side note to what our broader aspirations are. And that's the ability to determine our own future.
Right. So you get around a bit, right? You're a Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Sandy, which was that amazing movement to help people after Hurricane Sandy.
That's right.
I just can't imagine what it was like being in an apartment building in New York in November or December with no power.
Yeah.
So you were in and out of those buildings?
We were in and out of those buildings. So in the days, as soon as as soon as Hurricane Sandy, we knew it was coming. Me and three other folks, we activated the sort of Occupy Wall Street communication networks. And we're like, look, we got to get ready. We know that the state will not provide for our communities in a way that we can. So we wanted to, create this network of community-led rebuilding hubs that would be led by the people directly affected by the storm. And within 3 weeks, we had over 70 sites around the city and in New Jersey. We had upwards of 80,000 volunteers and people who were leading this effort, who were part of this effort. And the Red Cross and the city of New York was coming to us being like, tell us what buildings people are in. And we would go up in these buildings and, you know, the city of New York and the Red Cross were like, oh, you know, our liability doesn't allow us to go in these buildings in certain neighborhoods. And I was like, well, that's racist. But, you know, we don't share those views. We're going to go into these buildings. We're going to help our community. And we did. And it was crazy. I mean, we joked like it was like driving through a dark New York City streets. It was like the zombie apocalypse. It was just completely surreal.
And you've just got back from Paris, right? What were you doing there with something to do with Naomi Klein?
Yeah, I work with journalist Naomi Klein and her husband Avi Lewis, and we were just in Paris around the United Nations Climate Summit. We were there to be part of some of the civil society activities as well as to kind of cause as much trouble as we could.
Was this hands in the air trouble or another kind?
This was kind of intellectual thought. Trouble. We were doing some hands in the air trouble, but we were trying to. So Naomi's latest book is called This Changes Everything, and there's a companion film that I worked on and I'm actually in called This Changes Everything, which is directed by her husband Avi Lewis. And we're trying to support the sort of global movement that's arisen, that's resituating climate change not as an issue of science. If you believe that science is a thing, the science is conclusive. And so what we're trying to say is that ultimately climate change is fundamentally an issue of racial and economic justice. And the subtitle of her book sums it up, it's Capitalism versus the Climate. And we have this opportunity to understand that there's an intersection of many of these crises. And we have opportunities to address multiple crises all at once. And so we went to Paris with the goal of being able to support movement building across many different sectors, across many different cultures and nationalities around resituating our fight so we could build what quote unquote is called a movement of movements, a movement of many other movements focused on very important bread and butter issues, but that together can understand that we really need to build a new economic system that is collaborative and deeply democratic.
Your studio, you're in Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York.
That's
and
right.
Your studio is called Storyline.
Yeah, Storyline Media.
So where can they go to read more about your work?
You can check us out online at storyline.media. And we have a website up there and you can see a bunch of our projects that we have. We, in addition to the work that I do and I produce this work with Andrew Stern. I also have a collaborator named Rachel Falcone, who we run the studio with. And we do our own work, but we also accept commissions. People come to us and say, hey, look, there's something happening in our community. Would you come cover this? Would you come document this? And also sort of community-based organizations and NGOs will commission us to tell stories about their constituents.
That's amazing. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was photographer Michael Primo. His show with Andrew Stern is called Water Warriors, and it's on now at New Space Center for Photography. That's at 1632 Southeast 10th Avenue, and it runs through February 27th. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO, Michael.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you. Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the book release for Radical Mycology, a book on DIY mushroom cultivation, pollution cleanup, and more. The book release event will take place February